Mark.
Hello.
Thank you for coming on the show today. I really appreciate you taking the time. I'm learning more and more about charter cities, and I think it's a fascinating space at which you're kind of near the top, leading the way as you know, leading the Charter Cities Institute. So would love to hear, you know, obviously we'll talk a lot about charter cities, but I also want to talk about you a bit. Would love to hear your story and how you got to where you are now.
Sure. Thanks for having me on. So I guess my interest in charter cities started about 10 years ago. I was attending a talk, and the speaker briefly mentioned a guy named Michael Van Naughton, who was trying to build a free port in Somaliland. And it was basically just when I had finished college, and that kind of caught my attention and really got me down the rabbit hole. That summer, I went to stay with Spencer McCollum, who had edited Michael Van Naughton's book in Mexico, to learn more about the ideas. And there was basically a small community of folks interested in competitive governance and charter cities and things like seasteading. And I fell in with them, went to grad school at George Mason, did my PhD in economics, wrote my dissertation on charter cities, and then was kind of thinking about what happens after. I did a little bit of consulting work, for example, on a new city development in Kazakhstan, which helped, I guess, make concrete this idea that, okay, right, there are these really high-level ideas on what charter cities are, but actually doing, you know, just a little bit of consulting work on one on the ground, it made me realize, okay, like, how do you take these high-level ideas and then make them actionable? After graduate school, for a year, I worked for New Way Capital, an asset management firm, before deciding to go strike off on my own and start the Charter Cities Institute. And what I saw was that there were a lot of interested groups in charter cities that were kind of approaching this idea from different angles. But there was no coordinating body. And so given the magnitude of the challenge that there are about a little bit under 80 million new urban residents annually, it's imperative to move quite quickly because this is the last major urbanization that is happening in human history. And so effective coordination between all the different stakeholders, groups like UN, World Bank, that care about these challenges, that are starting to like inch their way towards charter cities, by showing them the projects that are happening on the ground, by coordinating between all of these groups, it's possible to rapidly accelerate the charter city space. And so that's what the Charter Cities Institute is doing.
That's great. I appreciate the background. I understand that you've had kind of exposure to government from a young age. I believe you spent some time, if not grew up totally in DC, parents in government as well. Was there any seed to all of this that might've been planted even earlier than 10 years ago that kind of sparked your interest in how governments should work and how they could be improved in the future?
Well, yeah, I mean, I've always been interested in ideas. I grew up in Bethesda, just outside of Washington, D.C. My dad has worked for a number of kind of alphabet soup, FDA, OMB, as well as some of the think tanks, AEI, in the D.C. area. And my mom has worked with PAHO, the Pan-American Health Organization, supporting childhood nutrition in Latin America. But I think my, I mean, my interest in kind of ideas in government, I think, really started in high school. I remember actually when we were reviewing the Articles of Confederation and before the Constitution, and I was thinking like, okay, well, these could be improved. We didn't necessarily need to throw them all out for the Constitution. You could have just amended them. And right, like, I don't really have a full like memory of all my thoughts during that time period, but I do very explicitly remember that one day in class. And that kind of got me interested in these ideas. I became a, I think, pretty hardcore libertarian in college. I've since moved away from that, I don't know, radicalism or like very strong belief in this notion of kind of predefined property rights. But that interest in, like, I guess, how governments work, how things function, how, like, how to think about society, how to think about the role of government society, I've always really been fascinated by it. And I suspect, I mean, my dad is an economist, and so we there was no, like, I don't know, moment per se, but I think just growing up, like, talking about ideas in our house. And then I guess my kind of I don't know, unique mindset and set of interests that drew me further down the rabbit hole. Got me to the point when I could hear about this Freeport idea in Somaliland, and that was enough to really just like jumpstart my interest and take me down the rabbit hole. And so, I mean, just for context, currently there's actually a Freeport being built in Somaliland by Dubai Ports World. They're investing about $400 million in a new port in Berbera. So my, I don't know, my interests in these ideas aren't coming from right. Like the Somaliland idea might not be as crazy as it might sound on first glance.
Sounds like an interesting project in Somalia. Would you care to talk a little bit more about that?
Oh, I don't know that much about it. Dubai Ports World is one of the largest port operators in the world. They for some of the older listeners, there was a big, I don't know, hubbub, I think like 13 years ago, 14 years ago in the U.S. when Dubai Ports World was buying an American port, and there were fears that, oh, well, if they control our port, then like, right, bad things might happen. We need an American company. But they're just a massive ports operator, and I haven't done much in-depth research on Dubai Ports World, on their project in Somaliland. So Somaliland is the northern part of Somalia. It's basically effectively been independent and self-governing since the civil war in 1991. It does not have international recognition yet, but it's kind of still hoping that it gets international recognition. It's just, I think most people hear Somaliland like a free port, and that's kind of a crazy idea. And it is a crazy idea, but it's just interesting that Dubai Ports World is building something there now. So perhaps not as crazy as initially thought. And then it's also part of this kind of broader, what might be called build out on the Horn of Africa, where there is a lot of port construction in that region. There is a lot of new infrastructure development in that region. Ethiopia has a relatively booming economy. So there's a lot of, I guess, economic activity that's happening in that area.
So I've done a lot of, you know, reading of some of your work and listened to a bunch of your podcasts, and I would call it an obsession with charter cities is fairly obvious, and I think it's great, and it's an awesome cause to be working for and committing your life to, at least for the time being. But there's not a whole lot to learn about you outside of charter cities, and I think this overwhelming interest in kind of how the world works and general economics and libertarianism, whatever you want to call it, there's a lot more interesting opinions that I think are in there that I'd like to bring out a little bit before we focus on charter cities. So with that said, I read a couple of your blogs, and you talk about, there's one that talks about, I think it's titled like COVID radicalized me or something like that. And it's about how you always believed that institutions were sort of getting old and declining, but now with COVID, it's really been exposed that they're pretty rotten to the core, I think you said. So it would be great to hear kind of your take on what's going wrong with institutions and how that's being exposed. And obviously later we'll talk about how charter cities, you know, core to them being successful is going to be building great institutions and starting them off with some great institutions local to the charter city. But would love to kind of hear your general take there.
Sure. So I guess the particular impetus for that article, it was written, I believe, in the kind of mid or late March, when COVID was right at the doorstep and nobody really knew what was going on, but it became clear that, I guess, things weren't working. And a timeline that can be reconstructed is, I actually look back at my tweets, and I think the first tweet I mentioned COVID was on like January 28th. And there was this group of folks, mostly who were somewhat adjacent to Silicon Valley, who kind of started paying attention. Oh, here's this virus in China. The first time I heard about it, I believe, was like January 8th or 9th. I was getting dinner with a friend and he mentioned this, and I just kind of assumed that this was like overblown. It wasn't serious. And then 2 days later, I saw the first news reports. I was like, okay, so maybe there's a thing. And right then it basically gets to late February and early March, when things still haven't shut down. I actually made a bet with a friend, will there be a quarantine or stay at home order in the U.S. within the next 2 months? And And she basically said, oh, no, of course, that's not going to happen. It's the U.S. And I was like, well, why? And she's just like, the answer was, it's not the U.S. And so there was just this, like, a pocket of people who saw what was happening, who were screaming it about at the top of their lungs. And then this just complete sense of obliviousness from almost all of the major institutions in power, where you had this tweet from, I think, mid-February, of a New York, I think the New York like health commissioner or something, who basically said, like, hey, we're going to go out and celebrate Chinese New Year. No, like, virus is going to stop us, blah, blah, blah. And just this complete, like, height of irresponsibility. I sent a very angry email to my grandmother's nursing home, basically telling them, like, you need to start taking everybody's temperature. You need to start locking it down. And they send an email back saying, like, oh, we're considering all the options, blah, blah, blah. We're following CDC guidelines. But it was obvious at that point that CDC was just, like, super far behind the curve. And I mean, they were saying, right, like, don't use masks don't help, which on one hand might have been this just deference to this very high standard of proof where there hasn't been a randomized controlled study of masks. And then on the other hand, it might have been in part because there was this fear of mask shortages that would then, and so they want to reserve the mask for medical and other frontline workers. And so, right, the essay came about at this point when it was, like, if you were paying a little bit of attention, it was clear what was happening. And all of the institutions were just weeks, if not months, behind people who were focusing. And while I think it's been clear for the past few decades that there has been this decline in state capacity in the U.S. and in many other Western nations, but let's focus on the U.S., where state capacity can be defined as the ability of the state to accomplish goals effectively. So can it build a road? Can it build an airport, a bridge? And a classic example of this is the Golden Gate Bridge was built during the Great Depression in, I think, 3 years. What it is effectively an on-ramp to the Golden Gate Bridge, it's a like mile and a half parkway, was built for multiple times the cost. And it took 7 years in the late 2000s, early 2010s. And the state is just much less effective at accomplishing these, like, large infrastructure tasks are relatively easy to compare. But it includes a wide variety of kind of, I don't know, competence and execution level ability. And while I did understand that there was this general decline in American institutions, what COVID, I think, really brought out was how bad it was, right? Like you had the FDA and the CDC shut down the first woman, a doctor named Helen Chu in Seattle, who found the first case of community spread, and she tells them, and they tell her, you need to stop testing because you haven't gotten proper approval. And all right, this pattern just repeated itself over and over again. It's August, or no, it's September. We still can't buy N95 masks. Right. It's just ridiculous. It's not a hard problem. The government just puts in a buy guarantee order and says we will buy all N95 masks at $20 a pop up to like a billion masks. And right. Like all of the factories will retrofit themselves. Not all of them, but a lot of factories will retrofit themselves once there's this guarantee in and start producing N95s. But we're 6 months into a pandemic and we haven't figured out how to build, like, I don't know, decades old technology and mass produce it. It is functionally absurd. And I think the way to understand, I guess, how we got to this position is several fold. One, there is Mansur Olson, who's an economist. He has a book called The Logic of Collective Action. But then his second book, which isn't as widely read, is called The Rise and Decline of Nations. And he takes this idea of the logic of collective action and applies it to like countries over time, where basically once countries kind of reach a certain point, all of these interest groups are entrenched. And so instead of figuring out how to build the pie, all these interest groups are effectively just fighting for the redistribution of the pie. And I think we've reached that point in America where there isn't this, I don't know, culture of vitality. There isn't this culture of building things. Tanner Greer had a very good blog recently where he describes America as appealing to management. So Americans used to be in the 19th century, this is what de Tocqueville described, if there's a problem, they'd come together, they'd form an association, they'd figure out how to solve the problem. Now, instead of figuring out how to solve the problem, there's instead an appeal to management. If there's a problem, what do? You write a petition to whoever is in charge to ask them to fix the problem. And so it's lost this willingness to kind of roll up the sleeves to understand what's going on. And I think part of the reason why Silicon Valley was so prescient in the coronavirus is it's really the only part of the economy that has this vitality left, where people are faced with a very wide degree of challenges, and there's a very wide set of actions that they must take to solve those challenges. And so there's this entrepreneurial spirit that is baked into the culture where, right, there isn't a deference of responsibility to other people. There is the understanding that ultimately it comes down to you, the entrepreneur, who needs to figure stuff out. And if you don't, then, right, the company doesn't exist, or you have to fire somebody, or, right, you have some very severe outcome. And this is a forcing function that requires people to be able to learn very quickly in areas outside of their expertise and react to those challenges. And because of that, if you look at COVID, right, Silicon Valley, they sent home all of their employees to work much earlier. There was the famous Recode article that was making fun of mostly Andreessen Horowitz for asking people to wash their hands in early February, which was a month before, right, most federal institutions kind of began taking this problem a little bit seriously. And this can be contrasted with a sector like banking, where to become the executive of a bank, you need to work your way up the ranks. And because banking has been established in the U.S. for a century, there isn't a wide set of choices that you have to make, right? The set of choices of a banking executive is much more constrained than the set of choices of a newer company in a newer space. And second, because the newer companies in the newer spaces, the executives are frequently the founders, the person who built them from scratch, who understands this wide, right, like, I don't know, they have the vision, they understand the set of challenges, while the banking executive works their way up through the ranks, all the kind of uniqueness and individuality is beaten out of them. So by the time they become that executive, they have a constrained action set, and they've basically been trained and indoctrinated not to have this, like, I don't know, wide knowledge set. And so effectively what this means is one, like most of the administrative class in the US has never really faced a serious challenge, right? What do? They get an undergrad at Harvard or Yale or University of Chicago, and then they go work for a few years, maybe in management consulting, maybe in investment banking, maybe they're on the Hill. Then they go back to grad school, they get an MBA, they get an MPP, whatever it is. But they've never really faced this asymmetric downside risk where it's like, I don't know how I'm going to make payroll next year, or here is this like huge shock that is coming and I don't know how to deal with it. And because of that, they aren't willing to actually think outside the box when they are presented with these new external challenges. And this, I think, is reflected in how, right, this administrative class broadly reacted to the coronavirus, where they did not, they were unable and unwilling to kind of take proactive steps and solutions. There were organizations like my grandmother's nursing home that just intrinsically trusted, like the CDC and these other organizations, that if you spent a few hours reading, were very obviously failing on a number of margins and would require, right, like somebody to basically think for themselves. But this broad, I think, administrative class failure just cascaded with coronavirus, and I think illustrated how bankrupt and faulty a lot of our institutions are. And this is, I think, part of this, I think, broad challenge we're facing for the 21st century, is how to revive and revitalize liberalism institutions to get back to something that looks healthy, where people are optimistic about the future, where people can undertake in long-term projects, where, right, we aren't leaving whole classes of people behind, that can get to this, I don't know, good, healthy, prosperous country again. And part of this requires an understanding of where our institutions are today, and then two, beginning to map out what it looks like to rebuild and to revitalize these institutions to ensure, okay, if COVID happens, if something else happens, we are able to effectively respond to that threat to ensure that, right, we humanity can continue to survive and flourish in the future to come.
That's a great synopsis of everything that happened, and really enjoyed your perspective on kind of why a lot of this is playing out the way that it is. One of the things you spoke about was, and you wrote about in your blog, was how one of the issues is that basically we have a kind of an unserious elite that's easily distracted and resistant to change. One thing you wrote was, our ruling class ignores the greatest threat to our way of life and a generation to focus on topics that aren't relevant. Could you expand a little bit on what you meant by that?
Sure. I think, well, one example is the UN. They tweeted, I think like yesterday, that COVID exposes how like centuries and millennium of patriarchy have damaged everything, blah, blah, blah. And it's just, it's like, look, I mean, patriarchy is bad, right? We should have women's equality. That is a good thing. But it just, right, like has, I don't know, absolutely nothing to do with COVID, and we should focus on COVID as the problem. I think we're seeing this also right now in California, where there is, I mean, they literally cannot keep the lights on, and the state is burning, and a lot of the cities are becoming much more difficult to live in because of the large amounts of smoke and other air pollution, which is the result of basically a series of decisions that were made in kind of the 70s and 80s with regards to controlled burn that might be able to minimize like these wildfires that really cause this huge amount of damage, as well as to limit nuclear power and other options that could provide electricity, could minimize carbon emissions, and could ensure that the lights stay on. And the reaction to these challenges, I mean, it should be like fundamentally embarrassing that one of the most innovative cities in the world, San Francisco, literally has to go through brownouts. This is something that happens in emerging markets that should not happen in the wealthiest nation in the world, and it should not happen in one of the wealthiest cities in the wealthiest nation in the world. And there does not appear to be a serious attempt to actually correct this. It's just been decided that, okay, we are going to have to live with brownouts. We're going to have to live with rationing electricity. And that is just a fact of life. Similar how we've kind of decided, okay, we can live with COVID instead of rolling out mass testing, instead of being innovative, instead of figuring out how to solve these problems. And so I think what one of the things that has happened with COVID is we're facing, it's not an existential threat, but it's a pretty substantial threat to our livelihood, to our well-being, to our lives. And the response has been to basically piggyback a lot of pre-existing talking points instead of just deciding like, okay, here's a problem. Let us go figure out how to solve this problem. Let's put aside whatever existing differences are, and go ensure that we can, right, minimize the disruption to our life from this very significant microbial threat.
Yeah, I think from my perspective, a part of the issue is that organizations from the largest companies in the world to the largest governments in the world, I believe they're making decisions less so based on, you know, addressing the problem, like you said, and more so based on what is everyone else doing and what do we kind of need to do to not be, you know, lit up by the media or, you know, what looks right rather than kind of what is right or what could be right. And the lack of willingness to take risk or do something that might ruffle some feathers is really serving a disadvantage when kind of everyone has to do the same moves at once, more or less. And I think you see that with, like you mentioned earlier, banks that were a lot later to come to this in the United States than, you know, some of the companies, tech companies in the Valley. But they all ended up more or less doing the same thing where everyone's working remotely now. No one's really experimented with going back into the office with certain policies and procedures. And no one, of course, is an exaggeration, but everyone kind of just like follows the leader based on something that hasn't really proven to work all that well in the way that the world is combating this thing. And I think hopefully some of the things and the regulations and governance methods that you guys will be implementing with charter cities might encourage people, I would hope, to think a little bit more outside of the box and be willing to experiment, which charter cities as a whole kind of is one large experiment. Last thing before we head over to that territory, everything that we're talking about kind of hits on this lack of progress and innovation. Everything seems like it's advancing very quickly, but it's all within the world of online and, you know, mobile apps and you know, software businesses and things like that. Peter Thiel famously said we were promised flying cars but got 140 characters. Tyler Cohen, who I understand you're very familiar with and serves as somewhat of a mentor to you, I think, you know, wrote about the Great Stagnation. And Mark Andreessen recently came out with the, or not so recently, but a few months ago, came out with the famous Time to Build article. So would love to hear kind of what your thoughts are on those three individuals. And maybe you could speak especially to Tyler, having known him fairly personally, I think.
Sure. So let me, I guess, respond to a point you made previously. I do think there are pockets, what might be described as pockets of effectiveness in the U.S. So the University of Illinois, it was tweeted like a week or two ago that they had done about 1.3% of the total tests, COVID tests in the U.S. because they basically just assigned to mass tests. You have the MBA, which has very effectively set up effectively a bubble for all the playoff teams and just having massive testing, keeping everybody in the bubble. And that has been quite successful. So you are seeing this, right, like some groups experiment and some groups be innovative, but it's just not nearly, I think, the extent that we would have seen 50 years ago, 70 years ago, 100 years ago in terms of the willingness to tackle this challenge and figure it out. I guess then to respond and to comment on, well, let's go in, I don't know, random order. So Mark Andreessen, I think he really managed to capture this, I don't know, sentiment with the Time to Build essay, this frustration with the stagnation. It's quite interesting because he had a debate with Peter Thiel, I think about 10 years ago, where Peter was taking the stagnation argument and Mark was taking the no stagnation argument. And Mark, with this Time to Build essay, seems to have largely come around to the stagnation argument. And I think this has probably been one of the most significant cultural shifts over the last decade or so, is that 10 years ago, there was this common assumption, like things are moving really fast, things have never been moving this fast. And now there's this widespread agreement, at least within a certain class of people, kind of the people who are tech adjacent or in the technology sphere. But even a little bit more broadly, people like Ross Douhat at the New York Times are largely bought into this kind of stagnation argument, which was, I think, to a certain extent, pioneered by Peter Thiel. Tyler Cowen frequently describes him as the most, I don't know, influential public intellectual on the right, which I'm not sure he is the most influential, but he's definitely one of the top five in terms of how people have largely adopted his positions, his talking points with regards to the lack of innovation and the fundamental challenge that has for a society that has really been predicated on innovation, on advancement for the past several generations. And I think with Tyler, so Tyler's been quite supportive. He's given an Emergent Ventures grant to the Charter Cities Institute. He shared a lot of our work. One of our donors found out about us via Tyler sharing some of our stuff on Marginal Revolution. And he's proven to be a very, I think, strong network for people who have this set of beliefs, this set of ideas about stagnation, about challenge. Because if we look at, I guess, the sociological network, the spread of these stagnation ideas, it was really Peter Thiel. And they've been adopted by a lot of people in the Valley, but for ideas to have a bigger impact, they need to be adopted by a wider audience. And Tyler was, I think, one of the key people with his book, The Great Stagnation, that had this be adopted by a wider audience, combined with the fact that because Tyler sits at least partially in the econ world, which has a disproportionate influence on policy, he's been able to not so much impact current policymakers, but hopefully to help impact and influence the next generation of policymakers to begin to identify this mindset. And so you see a lot of like new branches of the trees of people who got like master's degrees at Mercatus are now some of the most innovative policy thinkers in the US, many of whom were influenced by Tyler. You see this spreading with across the Atlantic with Works in Progress, a great new magazine by Ben Southwood, Saloni, and Sam Bowman. And so you're beginning to see this gestation of the idea go from something that was relatively niche to become widespread, to have a cultural impact. And hopefully over the coming years, we can really see that begin to take off to the extent that hopefully we can start nudging and inching our institutions towards more effective functionality, towards taking these challenges more seriously and figuring out how to restart the engine of economic growth.
All right. Well, I appreciate you sharing your perspective on all of this. I know it's a little tangential to what you do most days every day, but or all day every day. But I do want to talk about charter cities now. I've brought them up certainly enough times, and people are probably wondering, first and foremost, what is a charter city? So I would love to hear your kind of introduction there.
Sure. So a charter city is a new city with better laws. And the idea of charter cities comes from, I think, several challenges facing the world today. One is rapid urbanization. There are a little bit under 80 million new urban residents annually, 80 million. So that's, I don't know, the population of the UK is added to the urban population every year. And most of these new urban residents are in the global south, in Africa, in Asia. And the urban areas that they are moving to are not particularly functional. The U.S., when we urbanized, our per capita income, when we hit, I think, 50% urbanization, was like $7,500. And if we look at where the urbanization is taking place, the per capita income is much lower than it was in the current high-income countries. So basically, urbanizing at lower income levels and facing this wide, I don't know, breadth of challenges in terms of things such as urbanization without industrialization. So typically, urbanization has been accompanied by improvements in productivity, improvements in economic growth. So people move to cities, they are part of a larger labor network, they're able to gain more skills, they become more productive, their kids get better jobs, and this is part of the general cycle of economic growth. And now what is happening, at least in parts of sub-Saharan Africa, is there's urbanization without industrialization. So people are moving to cities, but not actually getting this degree of economic growth. And so instead of moving to a city, starting out in a slum, and then your kids have much better lives, the kids are kind of condemned to live in slums as well. And so that's one challenge, this very rapid urbanization that's happening that does not have the right infrastructure, either in terms of physical infrastructure or in terms of institutions to help deal with it. The second challenge is governance. So governance can be very difficult to reform, particularly on the national level. But governance is key to long-run economic growth. If you have good governance, you will tend to do relatively well. If you have poor governance, you will tend to do relatively poorly. So the question is, how can you reform governance to lead to long-term economic growth, to lead to these good outcomes? And instead of focusing on the national level, why not focus on the subnational level, particularly on greenfield sites where nobody currently lives? Because of the rapid urbanization, people are going to live there in 5 years, in 10 years, right? These new urban spaces need to be built. So why not couple these new urban spaces with these legal and regulatory reforms that can ensure the infrastructure, the institutions to help with long-term economic development? And so charter cities kind of take this importance of governance combined with this very rapid urbanization that's occurring and come up with a solution that allows for these new urban residents to have more opportunities than they otherwise would have, to have improved governance that can hopefully make these cities grow between 1 percentage point and 3 percentage points faster than they would have otherwise grown without these special institutions. And then two, hopefully they can also basically serve as a beacon, a success that the rest of the country can adopt similar reforms, nearby countries can adopt similar reforms to help really spread these reforms much more widely and stimulate economic growth much more strongly than might otherwise be the case.
So let me know if this is about right. I've been reading and you know learning about charter cities, but just going off of what you just said, basically people are moving to cities no matter what we do, 80 million people a year. And so there's this large urbanization and cities are going to need to be built regardless. And so the aim of charter cities is, you know, can we do this better than has been done in the past? Can we experiment a little bit with new forms of governance? And through those measures, basically create better cities than we have in the past, or at least better infrastructure and governed cities than we have in the past to enable people, especially in emerging areas in Africa and Southeast Asia and otherwise, to hopefully lift people out of poverty at a faster clip. And then at the same time, basically show or demonstrate how certain laws or approaches can then be drawn from these successful examples to then be applied to larger countries and more successful countries around the world to then improve their well-being as well.
Yeah, I think that's right. Well, I guess what I would emphasize is this is, I think, if we think about Chicago, right, one of the great American cities that grew primarily in the 19th century, I'm not sure it being a charter city would have helped that much. The U.S. had relatively good institutions. It was quite successful anyway. I think charter cities really help when the institutions are otherwise not performing as well as they reasonably could. And so that's focusing on countries, on regions that just don't have very effective institutions and coming up with this new model that can provide those solutions.
So there's a few different approaches to charter cities, from my understanding. And this is not a totally new idea by any means, but it's one that people like yourself, I imagine, are hopeful is kind of now is the time to begin to institute some of these measures around charter cities. And so the few approaches that I understand is one is Paul Romer gave a speech, a TED Talk, I think it was, about charter cities a little more than a decade ago, I think, around then. The Seasteading Institute basically introduced this idea of building communities, you could call it a charter city, basically on the water, you know, where countries kind of have nothing to lose, they're not giving up any land, and you're able to build communities and test new forms of government with, you know, water-based communities. Think of like a giant cruise ship or something like that. And then third, there's these examples that are sort of, you know, in the same realm, not necessarily defined as charter cities, but cities like Hong Kong and Singapore, Dubai, Shenzhen in China, that have kind of, you know, they haven't gone all the way towards actually calling themselves charter cities and taking in all of these measures, but they've been very successful in their own right, testing some new things and then taking those, and then larger countries like China will take lessons from Hong Kong, for instance, and apply them countrywide. So we'd love to kind of hear your overview of the landscape, I guess, and how these different approaches fold into what you guys are doing at CCI.
Sure. So let's start with Paul Romer. He came up with the kind of modern conception of charter cities about 11 years ago in his TED Talk. He was advocating for a high-income country, for example, Canada, going into a low-income country, for example, Honduras, to effectively set up and administer the city. And the argument is Canada has good institutions. One way to transplant them is just for Canada to, right, like literally transplant its exact institutions to a low-income country. And then that low-income country would have more economic growth than would otherwise, or at least the city would have more economic growth than would otherwise be possible. And he goes to Madagascar and Honduras. Neither of those work out. And so he at least publicly loses interest and stops discussing and or focusing on charter cities. But his model was very similar to our model in the sense that it was focusing on low-income countries, how to improve institutions in low-income countries to stimulate economic growth. I think the important distinction is that while he was focusing on a high-income country acting as the guarantor, we are focusing on a public-private partnership between a new city developer and the host country. So the host country would work with a new city developer and figure out, okay, we want to have a charter city here. Let's create this special jurisdiction. So it doesn't run into some of the political challenges that Paul Romer's conception of charter cities does. And similarly, just given the institutional challenges of some high-income countries that we discussed earlier on this podcast, I'm not as convinced that, right, most high-income countries, I think their institutions are a lot weaker than people typically assume that they are. So that's Paul Romer's version. The second version is kind of the Seasteading Institute, which was founded, I think, 12 years ago. And they were focusing on creating floating platforms that could be used to experiment and improve law. And so while Paul Romer's Charter Cities version was focused very much on catch-up economic growth, how can we create institutions that allow for catch-up growth? The Seasteading Institute was much more focused on pushing the frontier. They weren't interested in catch-up growth with low-income residents. They were much more interested in attracting high productivity people, people like software programmers, doctors, lawyers, etc., and getting them on a floating island that could then experiment with laws and governance and really start to improve them. And so a statement frequently used by the seasteading folks was the U.S. is a country that runs on 240-year-old code, with the idea being, right, we haven't updated it, so seasteading can provide for a way for updating our governing institutions that might allow for more productivity in the future. They've since then changed their branding a little bit, now focusing on working with Pacific Island nations to help combat climate change. And what they found was basically that the cost of floating platforms is prohibitively expensive. And so even if there was a large productivity boost from having these seasteads, just the land cost is just too high to make economic sense. As such, they've focused on more Pacific Island nations in protective waters that can help provide for some solutions for climate change and other kind of challenges currently being faced by the world. And then I think the third, I guess, perspective, what we sometimes describe as proto-charter cities, cities like Shenzhen, Singapore, Hong Kong, Dubai, that do have this degree of authority of autonomy within the city government and have become magnificently successful over the last 2-3 generations, demonstrate that it is possible to grow from a swamp or a desert or a fishing village to a world-class city in 2 or 3 generations. And there's different lessons to learn from each of these cities. Hong Kong was a British colony, and the government basically established rule of law and then kept its hands off, and let economic growth happen. But there was a institutional infrastructure that worked there. In Singapore, Lee Kuan Yew, government had played a much more heavy hand in economic development, focusing on what industries to attract, focusing, building industrial parks, doing things like that. It was much more this state-led development model that Japan and South Korea also participated in. Shenzhen was more of a figure it out. So they devolved authority to the Shenzhen government and then basically said, figure it out. There was no model to work with. It was the phrase that's often used by Deng Xiaoping was crossing the river by feeling the stones with your feet. So there was no, right, I guess, really preordained plan. They had a goal that they wanted to get to, and then they just kind of experimented and figured it out until they got there. And then Dubai, the model was this kind of building major infrastructure projects combined with taking advantage of regional instability to become the financial center and the kind of commercial capital of the Middle East. And so it's important to note that all of these models had different aspects. It wasn't kind of just coming up with one thing to do. It was figuring out very specifically what is the context, what will be successful in this context, and then having the freedom of the city government to be able to operate within those contexts, to be able to create design institutions, as well as provide infrastructure to become successful.
So I understand there's a lot of complexities that obviously could come up in trying to build the city from scratch, essentially, especially with new laws and alike. But for the sake of giving kind of the simplest possible example, I would love to hear your take on kind of what would be the perfect opportunity to build a charter city? What does that look like? And then Step by step, how do you actually go about taking advantage of that opportunity and building a successful charter city?
Sure. So I think the best example is a country that wants a charter city to be there. So the country needs to pass legislation that allows for the creation of the charter city. There should be a degree of political stability, so you can be confident that if the government's not going to change their mind in 5 or 10 years, and you will continue to have that charter city status. And that can be quite challenging because the nature of charter cities is that they have the most impact, potential for impact in the countries that are more dysfunctional. So you're trying to thread this needle where you need a country that's dysfunctional enough to need a charter city, but also functional enough to be able to make a promise to develop a charter city and then commit to that promise. Second, after that, you need land. And so land can be quite challenging to acquire. If you're building a city, you want a few hundred square kilometers at least. And so how do you get this size of land that is sufficient for city development? Where is it located? What is the water source for the land? There's all these questions about what makes good land, where is the nearest infrastructure, things like that. So then you have the country and you have the land. Third is you need there to be ideally a rapidly urbanizing population. The U.S. hasn't really built any new cities in the last 40 or so years because we have a lot of existing cities and because our population growth rate is much lower than it used to be. And so there isn't nearly as much demand for new cities as there was 100 years ago in the U.S. 100 years ago, the population of L.A. was just a few hundred thousand people. And now it's a city of, I think, 11 million or so. And so you need this demand for new cities, which typically comes from a rapidly urbanizing population. So if you have land, if you have a host country that is welcoming, if you have the potential population, then what you need to do is several things. You need to develop a plan. And this is both a master plan as well as a governance plan. Where is the power plant going to be? What do the streets look like? How are you going to build out sewers? You need the governance. What are the departments for the city government? What do they do? How do they create labor law? How do they create environmental law? How do they create a business registry? Things like that. You need to identify who the anchor tenants are going to be. What industries are going to attract to the city? What are they going to produce? You want to link that with the existing economic region. So think about what economic activity is happening in the region. If they're producing palm oil, maybe you want to do a palm oil manufacturing in the city to get it off the ground. What industries lead to these positive long-term economic effects? Some industries don't have positive externalities. Other industries have lots of positive externalities. You want to focus on attracting the industries that have positive externalities. So you can set it off on the right foot for this kind of long-term economic growth. And I think then the last kind of piece of the puzzle is the financing. You need to ensure that there is a financial model that can attract the type of investment needed to build a charter city. And once you have, I think, these things in place, and once you have all the stakeholders with agreement, then it's just a matter of execution. And obviously, execution is extremely challenging in and of itself. But right now, there's a few charter cities that are in the kind of execution phase, but most of them are still really in the ideation phase, and this model hasn't really been established. And so what we see as key to the long-term success of the charter cities movement, of the charter city space, is developing this general model that hopefully can be replicable a dozen, two dozen times, that allows for the development of dozens of charter cities that can really have the potential impact, just because it's not enough to have one or two. Given the magnitude and the scope of this challenge, it's important to really figure out how to create a charter cities industry that can produce a lot more than just one or two.
There's a famous quote, if you build it, they will come, and kind of what you're describing, you build the ideal charter city in the ideal location with a government that's stable but kind of needs a charter city and kind of threads the needle, like you mentioned, and you've got a rapidly urbanizing population nearby and all the various factors that go into building kind of the perfect charter city. What do you make of the notion that this could kind of be flipped on its head, where rather than building the perfect place and then having people, be attracted to that, that you could take kind of a community that's already built online and then, have them kind of build a community because they want one already. It's not something that you need to attract people, but it's something that you're effectuating on behalf of a community that already exists.
I'm like very skeptical of that idea. I like to joke there's three ways to start a city. You can be a government. If you're a government, you have much different budget constraints than a typical company. And so you can build a new city and then you can just force all the bureaucrats to live there. And that's happened a lot of times in human history. Brazil, Abuja in Nigeria, Astana in Kazakhstan. Two is there's an economic reason. And this is typically there's a natural port or sometimes a mine where people start to live together and then the benefits of living together outgrow the initial economic reason, whether it's a port or a mine, such that, right, people just continue to live there. The third way you can do it is you can start a religion. And this is basically, right, like with Israel or with Salt Lake City, where you can think about one of some of the, I don't know, worst examples, like with Jonestown. But you need to, right, have people have a strong enough sense of a shared identity that they are all willing to pack up and move to a new area, a new location. It doesn't have to be a religion per se. It could be something like we're about to see a mass migration from Hong Kong, and there they have a shared identity that's not religious, it's civic. But that might be enough to, right, like coalesce to build a, to get it to a new city. And then combined with this strong sense of identity, whether it's religious or civic, there also needs to be a degree of persecution. So why did Israel, or why did the Jews flee to Israel in the early 20th century? Because they were getting severely persecuted in Eastern Europe. Why did the Mormons go to Utah? Because they were getting persecuted at every town they stopped in the Eastern United States. Why did the Jonestown folks go to Jonestown? Again, because they were sort of being persecuted by California where they were. So you need this combination of a strong identity and a degree of persecution. And right now where there are a lot of these discussions of typically in the technology space, they're just right, like there is a tech identity, but it just isn't nearly strong enough yet. What I see happening is basically everybody wants to leave San Francisco for a combination of reasons. One, exorbitantly high housing prices. Two, very poor governance, the needles and the feces on the ground. Three, a city that is actively antagonistic, as well as a state that is actively antagonistic to tech. And then to a certain extent, also this ideological monoculture that people sometimes want to escape from. They talk to a bunch of their friends, and all their friends say, okay, we want to leave too. But the problem is all of their friends are also talking to their friends. And so even if you have these thousands of people who want to leave, coordinating them becomes extremely difficult. And then because the persecution isn't like on any margin comparable to some of the persecutions that I discussed, for example, the Jews in Eastern Europe, for example, right, like the Hong Kong population, the competition then becomes, right, like, I don't know, much stronger in terms of places like Austin, Texas, or Seattle, or Miami, or Denver, Colorado. While there is a degree of a tech identity, it just isn't nearly as strong as a religious identity or as a civic identity. I'm quite skeptical that the pieces are in place. Perhaps they will become in place over the next 10, 20 years. But I think there a lot more groundwork needs to be laid before there is kind of this, I don't know, right, like mass migration based on a shared online identity to specific areas to build new communities. And then two, even if they do this, even if the new communities are built, there's the open question of whether they actually become new cities, just because the demographics aren't really there. The U.S. has below replacement level births. Our population is only growing because of immigration. And so I'm just quite skeptical that there is that much demand for these new intentional communities, and that the identities are strong enough to really cohere them together and to solve that coordination problem to get everybody to move to a place in one go.
All right. So picking up off of that, would love to hear about, you know, what you guys are doing at Charter Cities Institute today, and what's an interesting project that you guys currently have underway.
Sure. So well, we've been doing a lot of thinking about, right, what is a Charter Cities Institute and what are we doing? And when I started this, there wasn't really much of, there was like, you could know all the people interested in charter cities. And now it's changed. There's a lot more people interested in charter cities. And so we have been under, like, working with several new city developments. We basically realized that because we are a nonprofit, the primary value add of the Charter Cities Institute is to provide public goods in the charter city space. And what does this mean? Like, broadly, we want to create a charter cities ecosystem. So we see all of these stakeholders who are interested in charter cities, but they don't really realize it yet. They're kind of approaching it from different angles. And we believe that if we act as a convener, if we can bring these people together, if we can present a powerful vision, it's possible to, right, get them on board to unlock a tremendous amount of resources that can be directed towards charter cities. So organizations like the World Bank, maybe when they release like their annual report, they say, we are worried about governance and urbanization and migration and infrastructure. And we believe that there are like five possible ways to solve this. And charter cities is one of those solutions. And what does that do? That unlocks a huge amount of downstream resources. It means that a lot of the economists in the World Bank might start thinking about charter cities, researching charter cities. It means that the World Bank lending programs might be targeted toward charter cities. It means that government officials, when you talk to them, they can think, oh, I saw charter cities mentioned in that World Bank report, rather than who is this crazy person who is coming to talk to me. And so by creating this awareness, this understanding of charter cities, it's possible to unlock all these resources. Combined with, currently people use charter cities to mean a number of different things, right? There's different ideas. If we're able to create a standard mental model for charter cities, then it's much easier to find people to work with. When you go to talk to a government or an investor or a potential co-founder or a urban planner, whatever it is, once there is a little bit more knowledge and awareness about charter cities, right, you kind of skip the first three meetings where you're feeling each other out, right? Like, do we mean the same thing by these terms? And you're developing a much stronger understanding of what you can get to the core of the issue much quicker once these shared mental models do exist. And so what we see ourselves doing is like broadly creating the Charter Cities ecosystem, which kind of has two core elements. One is creating a Charter Cities industry cluster. And what this specifically means is that there are a lot of groups and stakeholders that have a lot of resources to add to Charter Cities, and Charter Cities can advance their values. And basically by unlocking these resources, it becomes much easier to build Charter Cities. And so we can compare this to Silicon Valley, right? Silicon Valley is an industry cluster in the sense that there are, right, like there are shared mental models. There are consistent financing streams to identify high potential people early on and give them the resources they need to succeed. There is an understanding of what product market fit is, of what, like, when you raise money, how you pitch, of all of these different things that ensure that it is able, like Silicon Valley is able to produce all of these technology companies and be much more innovative than much of the rest of the country. And so similarly, if we want dozens of charter cities, we need to create that sense of an industry cluster where there are these relationships, where there are these networks, where there are these shared ideas, where there are these funding streams, where there are these relevant supply chains to ensure that dozens of these charter cities can get built. The second part of building an ecosystem is building a movement. And what this means is right, developing this core sense of idea with this identity that comes with it. So for example, if we look at effective altruists, right, people have this core sense of what an effective altruist means. If an effective altruist leaves one organization and goes to work for the government or for a funding organization or whatever it is, then people say, yes, this is great. Now, because we understand that they share our values, they share our beliefs, they can unlock this greater pool of resources. And so within the Charter City space, what that means is, okay, if somebody works for the Charter Cities Institute and then goes and leaves and works for another organization, like the government or like a funding organization, whatever it is, then we know that, okay, we have somebody who shares our values, who shares our beliefs, who can help advocate for Charter Cities within this broader context, even if they're no longer working for us directly with us, but they can still work with us. And right, having this, I think, shared sense of identity, this shared understanding, these shared values, allows us to hopefully activate this much wider scope of resources that can be used to help create dozens of charter cities.
Well, Mark, I appreciate the time today. I think what you're doing is awesome, and I hope all of that comes to fruition for Charter Cities Institute and for you personally in all your endeavors. I want to give you the last word to tell people where to find you online or talk about anything that you didn't get the chance to today. But thanks again for coming on the show, and it was really great talking with you.
Sure, thanks. So you can find me online at mark@marklutter.com, our Twitter handle is cci.city. We're also on Facebook, we're on Instagram, we're on LinkedIn, and we have a podcast, we have a blog, we have a lot of research papers. If you're interested in these ideas, shoot me an email and let's get in touch. So yeah, thanks so much for having me.